where you could hear him say, okay, let's go over that again. And to see hear him all relaxed and talking about his ideas was kind of a mind blow for me.
Yeah, whenever you hear any audio of John Coltrane talking, it's very rare. I have a piece at home with him and I think it's Gene Gleason, the Downbeat reporter. And this is only the second time I've ever heard Train's voice. So let's go back into this. This is brilliant. Thanks for bringing this up here, Mike.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah. On Kill Radio.
In a way you do, but like when? That seems like the part that you don't have much to do with.
Much control over.
Yeah, like when is swimming, you know, you kind of set your course with when you arrive and things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always happen as you plan, you know, you don't know that's
sure.
Somewhere else. You know, you can kind of set it.
Before you got interested in philosophy starting to think about philosophy,
it started with religion, I guess. More talks from childhood, you know, religion. And then the first question of religion. That brought on everything. You know, when I got to these, where I was to start to wonder about things.
Mm-hmm. What faith were you brought up in, Jim?
Methodist.
Did you have a very strict religious life, or was it that?
Well, it wasn't too strict, but it was there. I mean, like my grandfather, sure, my grandfather was a minister. My mother, she was religious. But, like in my early years, she went to church every Sunday and stuff like that. Being the influence of her grandfather, he was the dominating character in the family. Actually, he was the most well-versed, I guess, politically. He was most active, you know. My father was a tailor, but he never seemed to say too much. He just went about his business, that was it, you know. But my grandfather, he was pretty militant, you know, politically inclined, and religion was his fear, you know. So that's what I grew up in there. And I guess I would just accept it, and I thought it helped certain things, in late teens, I started breaking away, you know, and lost certain things. Just growing up, so I questioned, you know, a lot of how I found in religion. I began to wonder about it. But 2 or 3 years later, maybe I was 22, 23, this Muslim thing, I got introduced to that, you know. And that kind of shook me. I had a lot of my friends, they weren't Muslim, you see. So I thought about that. Anyway, it took me to something I never thought about, you know, another religion, you know. So that started me to think. But I never did anything, but I just thought about it, you know. I was too busy with everything. And I forgot it. I think I put it out of my mind for several years. I didn't bother to think about it. And recently I started looking into, you know, well, maybe I can just see what people are thinking, you know. Because I realize that's what I'm trying to do, you know. That's why I turned to things like this, you know. I haven't devoted as much time to it as I want to. I haven't actually learned or covered as much ground as I like. I'd like to cover more ground, but I'd like to, you know, like get my own thoughts together, compose the way I feel like they should be, you know. I was like religion, man. I was disappointed when I found how many religions there were.
You were disappointed?
Yeah. I was not disappointed. I don't know what they
when I saw there were two different religions and kind of opposed somewhere to the next and so forth, you know, I was kind of through with that. And I was kind of confused. And I just couldn't believe that every one guy could be right, and of course he's right, somebody else got to be wrong, you know. If he is right, and all bad religions, you know.
Well, here's another kind of a chance of all the religions that there are actually being tied in with one another. And by that I mean, regardless of what they say or what they think, that the basic things that are involved in their religions are all actually tied in with the basic things that the next guy believes and the next guy believes and so on down the line. And then through history, through time, and through people acting on religions, they have tried to say, well, what I've got is right and what you've got is wrong because you call yourself this and I call myself that. And the people have actually changed the face of religion, so to speak, but the basic things involved are all pretty much the same.
Sure, I think the basic things would bring them all together, man, if there was anybody to say, well, get together.
In other words, then you would like to see something like a universal type religion where instead of there being all these differences and one guy knocking the next because he's
something different faith. It should be something like this.
But if there is something basic to all of them, then they should all get together.
Yeah, it should be. I think so. It should be that way. But like when you study, like you see what these people say about good, you know, philosophers, when they start talking about good and bad, man, they take those two words and go so far with it, man. It can be a complicated thing.
Well, I think...
It's got to be simple. I mean, really, to really go and get some good out of it, to really realize something, you got to make it simple. And I think religion, they pretty well, they've got it made if they can get together. Because when they say what their preach is good, I mean, it seems good to me.
Do you think that when you finish reading a certain number of books and have time to absorb and think these things over, that it will change you in any way or change your outlook on life in any way?
Well, I don't think it will change me. I think it will help me to understand, you know, like I'll be able to walk a little sure, you know, I'll be... Just take a little confusion away, you know. I think I'd be the same.
Do you think very many musicians are more than confused, just like everybody might
okay,
be?
Okay, we're back live on Kill Radio here with Mike Watt.
They might
and,
be interested in it.
Mike, tell the world what you were just saying about Coltrane's humility.
Yeah, it's really striking to me. Because I had this, you know, listening to the man's music and the way he inspired the cats he played with and probably the whole jazz scene. I don't know.
I think the majority of...
You think the voice of an angel. And to hear him... You know, he's just kind of down home, which was a mind blow.
Was there a little town in North Carolina?
Right.
Hamlet. South Carolina. Hamlet, South Carolina.
Or North Carolina.
North Carolina?
I think so.
You got to get a little closer to that mic, Mike.
I think, Hamlet. I think they put up a plaque for him. Or is it High Point or something like that? Small
but,
town, though.
No,
I know he lost his father young, and then he moved up to Philly.
Yeah.
And that's where he kind of got into the music more, though. But I think he was playing even back in North Carolina and really early in school.
When he went to Philly, you know who some of the first people who he met there were? The Heath Brothers.
Wow.
And he started playing around town. They said right around like in the early middle to late 40s when Train got to Philly, it was like a hotbed for jazz.
Yeah, Diz.
Yeah. It was in Philly before it got to New York.
Yeah. I've seen the house, Cousin Mary's house.
Really?
I wrote that song, Cousin Mary, and I seen the pad, and he lived in.
In Philly?
Yeah. I read this interesting.
A little closer to the mic, Mike.
interesting interview with her. She said he was very particular about his eggs.
I've heard that interview. I've heard that interview.
Yeah, she's wild.
She's still alive.
Yeah, Cousin Mary's still around. And just recently, they've been trying to save his house in Long Island where he wrote Love Supreme. They were going to tear it down and put up track housing. You know, he died at 40. And when I turned 40, I was in New York City. And you could take the train under Madison Square Garden, Penn Station, out to Long Island. There's a train stop called Pine Lawn. And right when you get off the train, there's the graveyard. And he's buried in Pine Lawn in a part of it called the Garden of Sanctuary. And I found his grave. It says John W. Coltrane. Very simple, plain grave. And I laid on it. I don't know if that was rude. But it was like this was the closest I was going to get to the man. And I laid there and I was looking up at the sky and thinking about him and how big and open the sky was and how it seemed to go forever. It evoked his music to me. And I was thinking, John Coltrane, when you were making an album, did you ever think of the hit single? And he didn't answer me, but he did give me a breath of insight, I think, in a way, about what music's about. It's not just connecting notes or hustling people or fooling them or outfits, costumes. I mean, all that stuff's part of the human endeavor, you know, but it's almost like I was reading this thing with him where they asked him, what are you trying to do? I think it was Frankowski. He asked him, what are you trying to do with your music? And he says, I want to uplift people. And so that's what I was thinking. Yeah. What a noble pursuit.
Mike Watt here on Kill Radio.
Kill Radio.
Kill Radio. Mike, we're going to go into another CD you brought up with us. You brought up here to the studio, Money Jungle, with Duke Ellington.
Yeah. And backing him up. Look at the sounds of L.A. here on Kill Radio.
North Vermont.
Backing him up is Charles Mingus, an L.A. cat, who was pretty intense on bass. And a composer in his... You know, it was crazy. There was this thing on the PBS about jazz or something. And Wynton Marsalis had something to do with it. And not a mention of Mingus.
Wow.
And I heard some cats were telling me their theory is that Wynton isn't a composer. And he's jealous of Mingus. So he didn't have him on the... How could you do any show on jazz without Charles Mingus? Again, I'm a little biased about the bass, but a guy to give the bass
but you know, I have a lot of respect for Wynton. I think he comes from a brilliant family. I think he's brilliant, but he said he doesn't like Miles Davis.
What's that about?
You know, he said he's more of a Louis Armstrong. Well, you know,
that's who was in the show big time.
Well, you know, Wynton came out of that whole New Orleans thing, and you can't knock him for that.
Not at all.
But anybody who doesn't like Miles Davis and is playing a trumpet, I mean.
I only got to see him play once. It was at the Hollywood Bowl.
Miles?
Later on, you know, close to his end.
Yeah.
It was still great.
I want to bang my head against the wall. I lived in the same period as he did, and I had several opportunities to go see Miles, but I just never did. Now, I feel bad about that. Yeah. So let's go into Duke Ellington. This is Duke Ellington.
Yeah,
Charles Mingus.
By Charles Mingus and Mr. Max.
That's right. There goes Mingus in the background. Yeah, looking like a Crip.
I know. Wild.
Yeah, and a very young Max Roach on that album cover.
That's right.
So let's go into this here on
the jungle.
Here on Kill Radio, tell a friend. Thanks for listening. Let's see. Let me tell the world. We just got a little conversation going here between who's the best bass player, Stanley Clark or Charles Mingus. And what were you just saying again about that little situation?
Well, this
situation?
Was in the late 60s.
A little closer to the mic there, Mike.
Yeah, and the record company, Atlantic Records, put Mingus together with Stanley Clark for this session, and Mingus is trying to teach Stanley Clark, take the A-Train, Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
And Mingus is like, I don't need to learn that, take the A-Train. And Mingus is like, whoa, what's this about? This young hotshot doesn't need to learn this? Well, I don't know much about electric bass anyway, you know. There's a guy, Nat King Cole's trio playing putting his stand-up through an amplifier. And
wow.
Well, I heard, you know, what can be done with that, and I don't think much of that. And so you could tell it was kind of the meeting of two generations.
Yeah.
And then, like you were saying about Stanley Clark, he went on, I guess, to be part of this fusion thing.
Yeah.
So he turned to Forever. And
with Chick Corea and all that.
Right, and Hal DiViola.
Hey, Chris just walked into the studio. Grab a mic, Chris. Grab a mic, and actually, maybe you can get that. We couldn't get that mic working. Let's see.
Check.
Can you?
Well, you guys go ahead. I'll work on it.
All right. Because Chris has a show here at Kill Radio.
Check.
Here you
check.
Go.
There you go.
And Chris
check.
Chris is a bass player, and I want Chris to give Mike some bass player questions.
Man, that's a tall order. I don't know what to ask. This is a ridiculous question. What makes you pick up the bass instead of the guitar?
Well, actually, D Boone's mother had me play bass. I was 13, and she thought we should have a band. And every record cover listed a guy on bass. We didn't really know what it was. In fact, from the pictures, it looked like a guitar with just four strings. And so for the first few years, that's what I played. I played a guitar with four strings. And then I remember the first year of high school.
Wait, you're saying you actually picked up a guitar and put four strings on it?
Yeah, we took off the two high strings. We thought that's all a bass was. It just had a skinnier neck. I didn't actually know the strings were bigger. I didn't know it was lower. I didn't know what it was, you know. You got to remember, I come from arena rock, so the closest you were was maybe a half mile from the stage, and so they were so little.
Kill Radio, wow, we switch CDs here on Kill Radio. Straight ahead jazz. With Mike Watt. Internet radio coming from Los Angeles. Part two of the Straight Ahead show with Mike Watt coming up in 5 seconds.
I couldn't
seconds.
See these guys. They were so far away. And you got to understand also the sound systems in those days. They're playing. I saw a lot of my gigs at the Long Beach Arena and stuff, and mainly the PA was just for the singer. These guys were powering these arenas from the stage. So the bass was just like this, you know. It was very hard to understand what was going on. Things came a long way. And then I was meeting people who played bass, and it seemed a lot of them were guitar players, and they went to bass because it was easier to get a gig because no one else wanted to play it. And things I'll tell you the things that really changed it
for me
was punk. Because with punk, you had young people just starting out. And all of a sudden, it wasn't where you put the lame guy. Because everybody was lame. Right? Everybody in the band. The drummer, the guitar, the singer. So in a lot of ways, the bass players in the punk bands were equal, especially up here in Hollywood. A lot of the bass players were women, which was a trip.
One of the baddest bass players in music in this country was a woman. You just mentioned her. She did all that stuff in Motown.
Oh, Carole King. Yeah, she did. If you ever see that TV, she did a lot of the TV music. The Wild Wild West. That bass line?
I was just off the air when I said that. Really? That was her?
That's her.
Oh, man, yeah.
Yeah, she played with a pick.
Wow.
She's got an incredible website. She talks about all those old days. 12 hours a day just, you know, jamming, coming up with stuff, improvising, stuff that would last forever. She played a lot of Beach Boy sessions.
Yeah.
Neil Diamond. Countless sessions. And yeah, there's a lot of debate about even maybe some James Jamerson credits was actually her playing, she claims.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, when I was young, of all the gigs I saw, I only saw one woman on stage that not playing tambourine. And she played bass. She was her name was Susie Quatro. She was in this Detroit band. She was opening for Alice Cooper. And that was a trip. You know, and then see the first punk shows in the late 70s, and bass players actually driving the bands. The guitars were more like texture, and it was the bass driving the band. I remember me and D. Boone going to our first gig and me telling him, you know, we can do this. You know, it was like, you know, this is a scene. We don't have to be just in the bedroom copying records, man. We can. These guys are writing their own songs, and they're just learning in front of everybody.
Isn't that funny how all artists say that? I'll never forget the first play I went to. I said, I can do that. I can do that.
It's like empowering, you know?
It's like that word, I can do that.
Yeah, and people forget about that. They sometimes think it's just a trend or a fashion, but some movements are kind of empowering. They open up the door and let people jump in the pool.
Yeah.
It's great.
Chris, your band, Sabretooth Tiger?
Yeah. That's
where can we hear it out?
Well, you know, we have a website, sabretoothtiger.net, but we're not going to play for another month or so not for a little while.
Well, I heard you guys over at the Silver Lake Lounge, and you were great, man. I didn't know you were. You guys are pretty good, man.
It was exactly what he was, you know, Mike was saying. It's like, we were practicing in front of people.
Well, you're pretty good. Well, Thelonious Monk would do that. He would practice in front of millions of people.
And then get up and dance. In fact, that interview, you know, Train played with Monk a little bit, and he talks about that.
Yeah.
The guy asked him, what are you thinking when he'd get up and dance? He goes, well, I didn't know what to think. He said a lot of times he couldn't see him because where he was standing on the stage.
But yeah. I can't believe it. That one concert in Sweden, he stopped the band.
Yeah.
Stopped the band.
What happened?
They weren't playing right. And it was thousands of people were in this auditorium, in this stadium. And he stopped the band. Like they were at a rehearsal session.
Yeah. Well, Mingus was notorious about that. There's a record I got of him playing at UCLA, and he throws the band off the stage.
Mingus was known for that. They said Mingus would walk up to you and punch you.
Yeah.
In rehearsal, if you weren't.
I read a story about Jackie McLean.
Yeah, he was
in. They're playing on stage, and McLean's doing a solo, and Mingus starts talking to some people at a table. So McLean says, "Okay," after the set, you know, he goes, "Okay, Mingus, that's it, man, I quit." And Mingus punches him and breaks his teeth and like messes up. And Jackie McLean grabs a knife, his knife, and tries to stab Mingus, but pulls away and just tore his shirt. And of course, a couple months later, McLean's back playing with him, right? And whenever things would get heavy, Mingus would open up his shirt and be like, "You gonna stab me, Jackie?"
Folks, you heard that.
Wild stuff.
Folks, you heard that on Kill Radio from Mike Watt. Nowhere else. We got it. I'm taping it. You know?
I think they were some intense personalities. Like we were talking about The Lighthouse.
Yeah.
And in the Miles autobiography, he talks about Max Roach saving his life. The bartender was going to stab Miles. And Max grabbed the knife. And here me and Pettibone, we see Max Roach play there, do his entire solo on the hi-hat. Not just the cymbals, but the stand. You know, on the sides. It's incredible for these, I think for me, myself. And to sit just a few feet away and all the history. It's trippy how some stuff isn't handed down so easy. You know, you have to kind of search it out. But it's well worth it. You know, young people now, I think, are maybe a little more open-minded than in the 70s when I was a teenager and stuff. And
You went to high school here in California.
That's again. Right. I'm class of 1976, San Pedro High.
Okay, Mike, we were off the air talking a little bit about your youth. You came out here with your dad.
From Virginia.
Yeah, and your dad was in the Navy. Go ahead, right. tell everybody.
Like, he was a sailor. He's a chief. Chief's like a sergeant if it was the Army. And he worked in the engine room. He's a machinist, mate. And it was closer to Vietnam here than Virginia. So that's why I ended up in San Pedro. There was a big Navy base in Long Beach at the time. And came here in the late 60s. And I never left.
And what
36 years. San Pedro High. George Hurley and D. Boone. Class 76.
And what year did you graduate?
76.
Okay, you came out 4 years after I did. Yeah.
So that's my... all my music history is San Pedro. I can go to
tree.
That's great. I can go to the tree where D. Boone jumped out on me. He thought I was a friend of his named Eskimo. He goes, "You're not Eskimo." I said, "No." And I said, "You know what? I had just moved from Navy housing to these projects, which happened to be next to the projects he lived in." So I take him to my pad, and he's reeling off all these bits. And I'm thinking, you know, I hadn't even turned 13 yet. Right? It's the summer before. And I'm thinking, man, this guy is the smartest dude in the world. And the next day he takes me to his pad, and he plays me this record called Class Clown by George Carlin. And all those bits he was feeling were off this record. He didn't make any of them up. I was like, "Oh, D-Bone." I didn't know.
He stole it from the master.
Yeah, he borrowed it. Or he passed it on to me. But, you know, the day before, I thought he was just going off the top of his head with this stuff. And he didn't... I should have kind of known, because he didn't pause for a second, you know. And how could he come up with this stuff, you know? But, you know, I was this young guy. But it had an incredible effect on my life because, yeah, I do bass for a living, which I would have never imagined.
And you do it well.
Thank you.
There's another celebrities down in San Pedro. All you great artists are down there. Burkowski, well, he was down there.
Well, he's buried there.
Yeah.
You know what it says on his gravestone?
Explain that. Who is that?
Charles Bukowski is a poet.
Yeah.
Charles Bukowski.
Yeah, and he lived up here for a while, but he ended up his last years in Pedro and wrote a lot of books.
Great poet.
Books of poetry.
I've I read a couple of his books, but I didn't know.
Confessions of a Dirty Old Man.
And you know what? Mickey Rourke was actually pretty good playing
him. Oh, Barfly.
Yeah, I mean, to tell you the truth, when I heard that Mickey Rourke was going to play Bukowski, I said, no way.
I've got a lot of recorded Bukowski, and in fact, I got a little interview where they asked him about that.
Really?
And he said it was okay, but he said what he didn't like about Mickey Rourke was the way he dressed. He said he wasn't as big of a slob. Bukowski said, you know, he used to comb his hair and stuff. So he thought Mickey Rourke kind of was a little too much.
Well, you know, when I heard Mickey Rourke got that part, I'm saying Mickey Rourke is a pretty boy. But he actually, I don't know what he did, but he uglied down for that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I love you, Bukowski, but he
did. Yeah, Bukowski was a character. He had, like, things hanging around.
Yeah.
I met him a few times at Pedro. Yeah. In fact, I remember asking him something. I was asking him about a scene in one of his books about where a bartender, he's in a bar and some guy keeps coming up to him and wanting him to go on a robbery with him. And he thinks he's a cop, you know, so he don't ever do it. And I said, was that true? And Bukowski says to me, look, boy, writing is for pretending. And I was thinking, whoa, you know, John Fogerty wasn't born on the bayou. Maybe he's right. Well, very northwest bayou, Berkeley or something.
Wow.
So he's buried in Pedro, in fact, not too far from D. Boone, same graveyard, across street from the Navy housing I came to. And you know what it says on his gravestone? Two words. Don't try.
Wow.
So I don't know exactly what he meant by that.
Well, actually, I get a lot of inspiration from Bukowski because I used to work. I worked in the post office for a little while, and Bukowski really didn't make it until he was like in his what?
50s.
Really? I thought like 40s.
Well, started to. I've got tapes of him like doing college circuit readings in the early 70s. Stuff.
Yeah. You know, I've never met a woman who didn't like Charles Bukowski.
Yeah, well, his writing's very human, you know? It's not a lot of bullshit. It's very plain speaking, and maybe that's what speaks to women.
You know, our tape just went out. I'm going to go back into Duke Ellington. Or else, Chris, why don't you talk to Mike while I change tapes here?
You're still playing these days.
Oh, yeah.
What's coming up?
I'm still playing. What I got coming up is a lot of touring. I got my 52nd tour coming up, Europe with the Stooges. Then I come back, and I've been invited to do some Canadian Jazz Festival gigs, like Winnipeg and Saskatoon with Kira Dose.
Yeah.
It's my oldest band.
Yeah,
it's just two basses. She's playing Black Flag. And then after that, I go do some more Europe gigs with Stooges, places like Greece and Serbia and Portugal.
When's that happening?
July. Then I come back and Perry asked me to headline the solar stage of Lollapalooza, so I'm going to do that. He also wants me to write the tour spiel, you know. I do tour diaries anyway, but he wants me to do it for the dealio. And then I made a new album with my bass organ drum trio, Second Man, and that will come out August 24th. And then I got another tour.
Yeah, you want to hook that up? Okay. And then we'll hook that up in a second. What's it like with playing with Iggy Pop?
Oh, well, he's the bow of the boat. I mean, it's kind of like playing with D. Boone. Like, if you know, I wasn't really born musician or entertainer or whatever. I get really afraid, but man, with a cat like that, you cannot be afraid on stage. These guys go all out.
Mike, we got another DJ on the line. He wants to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Are you out to your space, brother? I don't think. Hold on one.
Into the phone.
1 second. Let me go.
Space, brother.
A little winky in the studio.
Yeah, we're hearing.
Well, could talk to the phone to ask him.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. We have Space Brother who does the Sunday show here at Kill Radio. And he wants to ask Mike Watt a question because we were talking about Bukowski.
Yeah, Mike, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
All right. I, I was really happy to have somebody bring up Bukowski, obviously, for Los Angeles, but have you read it to John Fonte, who was Bukowski's, like, literary hero?
Ask the Dust.
Yeah, Ask the Dust. It's probably his best book.
There's a lot of Pedro in that book.
Yeah, because he lived there for quite a while.
That's right.
Yeah, he runs down there with that waitress or whatever she was.
You know, Greg, I was telling Mike that...
All crazy women, just like Bukowski. He just hung out with crazy women.
Bukowski's wife, Linda, still lives in Pedro.
Live where?
She still lives in Pedro, Linda Bukowski. She used to come to a lot of Minutemen gigs. She, mm-hmm. she saw me a few years ago.
Wow.
Play last. And, in Women, right, with the big giant sculpture of Bukowski's head. It's pretty funny. But like Hassan was saying, a lot of women like Bukowski's writing. It's funny because some people will say that he's misogynistic or something, but I don't know about that.
I could hardly hear anything.
Oh.
Can you hear us now?
I can hear you fine, Hassan.
Okay.
Because he's talking right in the phone. Is this better?
Yeah, a little bit better, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this mic you got to really get on.
Anyway, Greg, we were saying that I said I never met a woman who didn't like Charles Bukowski.
Yeah, if they know who he is. Doesn't that tell you something? I don't know. Maybe most or all women are crazy. They're the ones that we run into.
Yeah, that book,
something
Women,
something
is great.
You would say, I guess.
Have you ever heard this live record he did called Hostage?
No, a friend of mine has that. I haven't heard
of it. Yeah, it was recorded in 1980 at the Sweetwater in Redondo Beach, and they put a refrigerator on stage full of beer. And that's how long the gig lasted. You know, when the fridge ran out of the beers, as Toto, you know, it was over. So it's a pretty good thing. Harvey Kubernick put it out, a cat who was documenting a lot of voices from L.A.
Kubernick's great.
You know Harvey.
Yeah, we got him, yeah.
He's an old pal of mine.
The old poetry producer.
Yeah, that's right.
What's he doing these days?
It had to be an L.A. equivalent, I guess, of what? William Burroughs? I guess it would be Bukowski.
Yeah. He was earthy. Yeah, he talks about being at the same hotel as Burroughs once in that Woman book. And
didn't they meet?
They kind of, right there by the pool, and Bukowski kind of thinks that Burroughs is shining in him on and don't want to be the guy to talk first, so they never end up talking. I have a lot of respect for Bill Burroughs, too. I think he was an incredible writer.
William Burroughs is great. I mean, I've only just read a little bit of Naked Lunch and saw some of the movie. But
he's got a lot of recordings of his voice. There's nothing like Bill Burroughs.
Yeah, I know.
Uncle Bill reading his own stuff.
Yeah, it's that. I don't. You know, he wasn't really as much of a drinker. He's more of a junkie, and he's got that drawl in his voice.
No.
But Greg, he was selling All Stars on television.
He was selling what?
He was selling All Stars. Converse. No, Nikes. He was selling Nikes.
Burroughs was.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, well, probably he got screwed out of a lot of his book money early on.
Oh, well, that's cool. I'm sure he...
He was selling his paintings, too. He was making paintings by
shotgun.
Shooting paint with a shotgun at
Yeah, he ended up in Lawrence, Kansas.
I think that's where he spent most... Wasn't he from there?
Maybe originally. Kansas, I know he spent a lot of time in... Africa, Algeria and stuff, right? All that Bulls and Beatnik stuff.
Yeah, when he was younger.
Yeah, when he's younger. I think...
Where the opium flowed free.
Right. He was part of a family that invented the ad machine.
Burroughs.
And he got some, like, small money.
Yeah. He was one of those artists, like a lot of the surrealists, that were a bunch of bored rich kids that actually did something worthwhile.
Yeah. He's, like, kind of a trust fund.
Uh-huh.
And so he was able to live. Also, it was very cheap to live there at the time from reading his writings.
He's buried in St. Louis in the family plot with a big gravestone.
Wow.
And somebody told me that the grass over his grave seems greener than the other than the ones around it.
Oh, wow. You know, I read his last writings. There's a book of his last writings right before he died, and he talks a lot about his cats.
About what?
He loved his cats.
Wow. Oh yeah, he was incredible. He had a bunch of cats. He was an incredible cat lover. I don't know. I guess James Growl. I think his name is Growlerhouse or something. That was kind of his companion and secretary. Is still taking care of the estate and he just wrote a book on him. But there's some guy taking care of the estate and probably still feeding the cats.
Yeah. And Uncle Bill spoke.
Well, I'll let you go on. I won't interrupt.
Well,
the show anymore.
He spoke very kindly of his cats, though.
Yeah. Well, Greg, one last thing. We were talking about Barfly, man. Did you see that movie?
Yeah, I did. It's funny that like Mickey Rourke created a character that wasn't quite Bukowski, but was, you know, enough of that kind of character. He had this like kind of. He was speaking through his nose the whole time. And everything sounded like a I don't know. He was sneering the whole time.
Bukowski, I've got an interview where he was asked about that, and he said what he didn't get right was. The look. He said he dressed too much like a bum. He said,
"Yeah, Bukowski always had like suits on and combed his hair like."
Bukowski reminded everybody he was more dapper.
No matter what,
Mickey Rourke kind of dressed him down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, like I was saying, I actually started liking Rourke after I saw that movie. I just thought he was like another pretty boy Hollywood actor. But then I actually saw he had chops, Mike.
All right.
When he played Bukowski.
Some breath.
Yeah, and then he thought he was a boxer for a while and got beat up a lot.
Leave him alone, Greg.
I think Bukowski boxed when he was young.
Wow.
In fact, there's a little boxer on his gravestone.
Wow.
Kind of little.
On whose?
Bukowski's.
Oh, really?
There's a little silhouette, yeah, kind of.
Boxing was life.
I think he's from Philly originally, too.
Mickey Rourke?
No.
Bukowski?
Charles Bukowski?
No, he's from Germany. He was born in Germany.
Yeah, but he lived some years. You're right. He's born in Germany. He talks
Where's
about
Fonte
that in
buried?
His books.
What'd you say, Greg?
Where's John Fonte buried?
Oh, I wouldn't know that.
He actually had some money when he died because of his...
He ended up doing some television and stuff. Right. In fact, pretty mediocre stuff.
Mike just said he was doing some TV, Greg.
He was what?
Doing TV scripts and stuff near the
end. Yeah, he wrote TV and movie stuff, and he got completely disgusted with it, but he kept doing it, I think, because of the money.
Yeah.
And he was blind for about the last 20 years of his life because of diabetes.
Diabetes.
He dictated his books to his wife.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, anyway, everybody, this is Space Brother on the phone. He does a great show on Sunday.
10 p.m.?
The name of your Radio Mysterioso.
Yes.
Mysterioso, one of Thelonious Monk's songs.
Absolutely.
Okay, hey, Greg, thanks for calling in.
Okay, thanks, Hassan, and Mike there, and say hi to Chris, too.
Yeah, well,
heard him in there.
Chris is the one that got the phone jack up, so I want to thank Chris
for
helping us get this phone interview going.
All right, cool.
All right,
safe seas.
I'll see you, Greg.
All right, bye.
Okay.
So, let's go back into a little bit of this Duke Ellington now. Mike.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Thank you. back on Kill Radio, and with Duke Ellington and Charles Mingus in the background and
Max Roach.
And Max Roach. But Mike, tell us about you got an internet radio station in your bedroom.
Yeah, Bert Ehr.
And tell us about
it's
that.
It's actually a brother, Matt's.
How we can all hear it.
A friend of mine in Pedro, right next to the water, once a week for 3 hours. I do it. Basically, it's an extension of my show that I had on KBLT, the Watt from Pedro show, and you can get to it, twfps.com.
The Watt from time, Pedro say show. One more time, how to get to it.
twfps.com. And the current show's up, and then you can go to the archive and all my old shows. I've done 69 shows now. 3 hours each. I have guests on. I play records from my collection. I kind of stopped buying records and punk records in the early 80s. So my stuff isn't that current as far as that. But I do also play stuff that kids give me at gigs. Hey, my band, you know how it is these days. You can make CDs. Just anybody. And
well, Chris
so,
Evans said we might put you on our favorites here, make a link to your.
We need to do that.
Yeah.
That's
oh, no problem.
Yeah, that's a given.
No problem. You know, another thing the KBLT experience got me into was this whole low power FM movement. And, you know, the Constitution says freedom of press. Like they name the machine. And I am certain that if we had radio in those days, it would have been in there too. And for some reason, well, it's a pretty obvious reason, marketing forces want the airways to belong just with people with a lot of money. And these Clear Channel people and stuff with no grassroots thing, right? That's all programmed from some, whatever, bunker in San Antonio that's also organizing pro-war rallies, you know, to gain favor with the current gangsters or whatever in office. And the only thing to really balance that is the voice of the people, which I believe low power FM can do.
Well, it's interesting because from my involvement at KBLT and here, Mike, I found out how the FCC basically is a bunch of gangsters.
Yeah.
And you
got
to be a millionaire like Cal Worthington. I mean, I love Cal, but I mean, you got to be able to have all those commercials, you got to pay the FCC all that money. That's why they call it commercial TV or commercial radio.
But, yeah.
You know.
So there's no voice. People's voices are getting stifled, is what I'm trying to say. And it's not such a public airwave. And so I've been involved. In fact, Warren Olney has a show, Which Way LA.
I love Warren, yeah. Warren.
Right.
Warren's one of the best things at KCRW.
And he was very fair with me. He had me on the show on the phone, and I'm up there against the NPR guy and the NAB guy and, you know, these people who are dead set against having any kind of competition. You know, here I was raised with, I don't know how many years of Cold War propaganda about, oh, this system's better because it's open. And all those guys over there, their thing's all closed up. But then you grow up and you find the reality is there's a lot of closed up here too. And Mr. Olney was very gracious to let me have a voice in this so-called debate, you know, and let me over the airwaves speak my piece about this. Like in Pedro. Let's say the longshoremen, like the guys in my current band, or Pete and Jer, they're longshoremen. And the jobs are called out every night, you know, from the docks. Now, how can you have some station run by a conglomerate in San Antonio have anything to do with that, you know? You have to have a grassroot thing, you know? And if you got only a coverage area of a certain amount of miles, little local thing, you're only beholden to the little local thing. You don't have to worry about pleasing everybody with what do they call it, top 40.
Well, let me ask Chris this. I know Chris, there's like 30 or 40, like we got the Radio Volta, there's a bunch of progressive internet
station.
There's
a movement, you know. There's a movement. It's micro radio movement all over the country, and
Prometheus.
They're connected together. Prometheus Radio.
Absolutely.
Enemy Combatant Radio in San Francisco. We got
Volta. They've played the Watt from Pedro show. They've had me send discs of my show, and they played over there. I think they're Philly.
Yeah, Philadelphia. We've got Radio X in Seattle. We got Portland Indie Media doing radio there. We got Humboldt Free Radio up in Humboldt. You know,
there's a station in
San Diego. We got Radioactive Radio, which just started up. I mean, it's a movement.
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
There's Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
That's great.
So, Mike, one more time. What's your internet station again?
For Pedro Show, it's TWFPS.com. And, you know, a farmer would tell you if you want a good crop, you use a lot of manure. So I say keep it coming, FCC, NAB, NPR boys.
And you heard that from Mike Watt on Kill Radio.
Because they're growing the seeds that are going to bury them.
Yeah.
You watch.
Yeah.
You know, people just don't get lulled. I tell you what blows my mind. You know, I go on the internet, check the news, and there's stories about American Idol TV show. I mean, what's that about? Why is that news?
I know.
You know what? Who cares about that crap?
Just show you the state of mind we're in this country.
Yeah. You know, I guess it's a distraction thing. Keep people's minds off the real deal and caught up in silly stuff like that. So-called reality. It's funny they call it reality. You know what I mean? That shows you the total bum rush of the language. George Orwell sense of just doubling back on itself as far as the truth. It should be American Idol, IDLE.
Did you hear there was this guy who wanted to do an American Idol in Baghdad? Did you hear about it, Chris?
No, that sounds frightening.
I know.
Are they going to show the Abu Ghraib prison? What is it? Abu Ghraib?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not... That won't be shown on...
Was it America? It was one of those reality TV shows, and the guy's wife had to talk him out of it. He was some producer, and she talked him out of it. Yeah. Anyway, we don't get too political on Straight Ahead. I saved that for my news show. I do the news here, Mike. It's 6 o'clock on Mondays, too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but we're definitely going to try and get a link to your show here on our website.
Oh, great, because maybe some people are curious about Pedro. So they can... hear some guy who lives there and his take on music and spiel. Of course, when I play my old records, it brings back memories, so I tell stories. I tell things about what happens to me on tour and stuff.
Yeah, I wanted you to bring in some of your stuff. What are the Minutemen, what are the guys doing now?
Well, I played with George Hurley a few days ago.
Okay.
We played songs we hadn't played in 20 years, 25 years.
Cool.
It's interesting to revisit your music from all those years.
Cool.
It was very difficult to play.
Cool.
Minuteman, a huge impact on me. I'll always be Minuteman. But I did just make a new album. It's going to be out August 24th. I was almost killed by the sickness a couple years ago, so I made this whole opera about it.
Wow, we got to play it here on Kill Radio. Seriously.
It's a trippy thing, and I did it with the Second Man, this organ-based drum trio I have.
Yeah, tell us about that really quick. You're playing with these guys who are actually longshoremen.
Yeah, they unload boats.
Working in San Pedro, right. and they're musicians, too. And Mike wrote an opera with these guys. He did an opera with them. Tell us
about it. I can't play organ. I can't play drums, but I wrote all the parts. I did it. I taught it to them with my mouth. And showed on the bass, I would play their lines for them. It's quite interesting. The whole idea of a keyboard, you know, me and D-Boom grew up not knowing anybody. They were a lot of money and stuff. We didn't know anybody who owned one of those. But they're very interesting. They're almost like a pewter. It's like you got a button for each note. And they got all the notes.
Wow.
Seems, well, the guitar's pretty wide, but the bass really narrow instrument. Only a few... small part, I mean, it's a big part, the bottom. Small part of all the frequencies. So, and the organ can even go a little lower than the bass. So it put me in a situation where I could like kind of redefine myself. I used for the first time pedals, like fuzz tones and stuff.
Right.
You know, I